So, welcome to Personal Journeys to Difficult Truths, Understanding Islam, Understanding the West. I kept hearing such horrible things about people, including myself, who were exploring Islam. Islamophobe, right-wing, lunatic fringe, racist, Islamophobe. The names just didn't fit me. I've been for human rights all my life. They also didn't fit the little I knew about the people with similar concerns that I knew about. So I set out to find, who are we? What are we like? So, right now, welcome to Bill Warner. Bill is one of those...
Delighted to be here.
And I'm delighted to have you. I was so pleased that you accepted my invitation. You are one of those people who really impressed me. In all that you put into your writings, I'm going to tell people a little tiny bit about what you've done, and then I'm going to tell people why that's impressed me so much, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so you've been a university professor, a businessman, and a physics researcher. You're currently the director of the Center for the Study of Political Islam. You're a national and international speaker about Islamic political doctrine. You have produced a dozen books, including a Quran, a biography of Muhammad, and a summary of the political traditions of Muhammad. You devote all your time to the education of America about the true nature of Islam. Now, why has all that impressed me? You are amazingly fact-oriented, detailed-oriented, number-crunching. It's a delight to read your clear, precise writings. There's so much accuracy and information. I kept getting so many generalizations. We all do, you know, like Islam, religion of peace. And then it's such a relief. I read your stuff. Statistics, facts, information, number crunching, no generalizations. I mean, you do draw conclusions, but they come from facts. Give me the facts, ma'am. Nothing but the facts. It's wonderful. So, for example, you have an excellent book, Factual Persuasion. So, welcome, Bill.
A delight to be here. I think your idea, by the way, of interviewing people who are behind the ideas is really fabulous, because what you're going to discover is I've met many of these people, and they're wonderful people. I say to folks all the time, the best thing about what I do are the people I meet. The people I meet are all above average intelligence because they're swimming against the media tide. They're compassionate because they care for others. And they're also courageous. So I'm predicting that, although I may be the first, that you're going to meet some wonderful people who are compassionate and courageous.
I am sure I will meet people who are compassionate and courageous. It's taken me more courage in terms of talking with my students. I've been a college prof about this than about just about anything else. I realized I was, you know, having to tread so carefully because you're so likely to get name calling thrown at you, and it just boggled my mind. So I'm sure that everyone else who's doing it also needs to have courage and cares, because if you don't care, you don't bother. But
right.
Enough about the general. I said that you were a very specific, detail-oriented person, so let's talk about you. Who are you? What's your background? What got you to be the person you are with this intense interest in facts, accuracy, and truth?
It's odd you should ask this question, because I've recently asked myself the same question. How did I wind up doing this? But it's clear that my childhood roots had something to do with it. I was raised basically in Tennessee in what you would call Appalachia, a very small community of about 250 people. And I was raised in a devoutly religious family. So we went to church three times a week, whether we needed to or not. And by the time I was 16 years old, I was reading the commentaries and teaching adult Bible class. Indeed, my first job was going to be being a preacher. So it's odd that I've sort of come full circle in my own way. I'm a preacher now, but not at all what we intended in the beginning. But one of the key things that led me to doing what I'm doing is not only did I have an interest in religious text, even as a child, but I was also primarily raised by my grandmother, who was quarter Cherokee and who was noted for her blistering honesty. It turns out that the Cherokee Indians were sometimes used as arbiters and judges amongst tribes, other tribes of Indians, because the Cherokee were known for their truth-telling. And that was certainly my grandmother, and that's certainly the way I wound up being. So, and my beginning does foreshadow my end, speaking difficult truths to people who don't necessarily want to hear them.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. So you were, in fact, in a fairly marginalized group. You know, it's not an economically rich area, Appalachia.
No. You know, it's odd you mentioned marginalized. Here in the United States, we're not allowed to denigrate anybody except white Southern males, particularly if they're hillbillies, rednecks, trailer trash, white trash. You can use all of those terms in very polite university circles, and no one will even blink. So in the United States, I come from a people who are considered the social sunk, which was always very strange to me, because the community I grew up in, people were honest, hardworking. We didn't even own a front door key to our house. But we all you got to do is to watch Hollywood, and you'll discover that we're not very bright, and we're all bigots and racist. So anyway, such is life.
And yet your concern was the opposite, like it was about the truth of, that you were trying to find out the truth of the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, now you are once again interested in truth, and it's been quite a journey. Now, it wasn't, you didn't go straight from 16-year-old teaching Bible text to here's Islam.
To college. I was the first person in my county to ever take a standardized test. I mean, I came from back in the woods, didn't have running water until I went off to college. Never did have a telephone, and for a long time my telephone manners were very stiff. I wasn't used to holding a casual conversation. But went off to Vanderbilt University, and where I studied engineering, and there an event happened which was important to our story. I was in the bookstore, and there was a book on Asian art. And I picked it up and was intrigued by the beauty of the art, but it caused me to ask another question. Who were these people that they made art that was so different from mine? And so this led me into reading about Buddhism and Taoism. So that was, even as an engineer, I was beginning to sort of look towards other subjects.
And it was very positive. I mean, you weren't doing it as
I was just curious.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that gave me was a curiosity into mysticism. And so after I got out of graduate school, and I was in Princeton, New Jersey, I became then interested in a form of mysticism called Sufism, mystical Islam. And so I started buying books and went to talks by Sufi sheikhs and went to Sufi dances and did zikrs, and I was very much into learning about mystical Islam. And did that for about a year. And then, though, there were some things around the edges which sort of bothered me. And those things around the edges that bothered me were violence. Because in my reading of the Quran, that was like, gosh, the Quran didn't seem very mystical at all. As a matter of fact, it just seemed like brimstone and hell. So I dropped my study of Sufism, mystical Islam, and my next step on the journey was Zen Buddhism. So anyway, I started my study of mystical Islam about 40 years ago, 41 years ago. So that was my first view into Islam. It was as a seeker.
Right, and then I later started studying yoga, not just the health yoga, the hatha yoga, but other forms of yoga, jnana yoga, and others. The other thing I did was I didn't just read books. Even when I was studying Sufism, I wanted to go meet the teachers. And I've always been interested in being taught by, if you will, a native. I don't care much for college courses on religion. If I'm going to study Buddhism, I want to go sit with a Zen master or a Tibetan Lama or something. I want to get my facts as close to the source as possible.
That really fits with what you've written, because I was impressed by, like, I can really trust this guy's facts. I can totally trust his facts. I don't have to go check, did he do it? Did he, like, you know, is he just making this up? Is he fudging
Although
it?
Although I must say, Elsa, I've had people read my books and later come back to me and said, well, I read your book with a Quran at my elbow and Google on my keyboard, and I checked and checked and checked, and finally I just quit. It was like, okay, it's all here. So now actually, you know, the closest checking of any of my writing I've ever done, I just heard from a guy. I've had one of my books translated, of all things, into Arabic. So I now have a book in Arabic about Islam that was written by me.
Well, congratulations.
So, I've always wanted to go to the source.
Mm-hmm.
And to get as close to it as possible. I'm not that interested in reading other people's commentaries on any subject. I mean, I do read them, but only to introduce me enough. I want to read the source material. I want to go back to the source.
Mm. And that was 40 years ago. But it wasn't, you haven't had an ongoing interest in Islam.
Interest came when I was... when I was teaching in college, I taught for 8 years, and I had a lot of Muslim students. It was quite clear to me that there was a different psychology here. So like my study of Buddhism and Taoism came from realizing that the art was different, my study of Islam came from seeing that the personality was different.
In what way?
And so I couldn't put my finger on it. There was something slightly dodgy. There was a closeness, a sort of not looking at me, but looking out at me. And also, the other thing was the Muslim students could be overly solicitous. It was like, wait a minute here, you're working me too hard here. So anyway, I just started reading the Quran. And this time I read it completely all the way through. And having, by this time of my life, having read lots of other religious texts, including the study of Torah with an Orthodox rabbi, I was like, you know, this is different. This is very different. The chaos of the Quran was the first thing that impressed me. Of course, everyone is pretty soon impressed by the violence. Now, when I say chaos, I mean the Quran is a book which is in desperate need of editing. Not in the sense of changing any verse, but just putting things in the right time order and grouping everything together that's the same subject. So anyway, that was my second introduction to Islam, and it led me to be able to make my first historic prediction, which was on 9/11, my phone began to ring off the wall with people calling to tell me, man, you said something was going to happen. How did you know? Well, I knew because I read the playbook. I knew that Muhammad called the unbelievers to Islam before he attacked them. So when Osama bin Laden made his tape, back in those days, VCR tape, he called America to Islam. Well, what that said was, we're going to get attacked, because that's what Muhammad always did before he attacked.
And at that point, I realized that I had an answer to my lifelong question. Because I was in a position of life for 60 years, I was 60 at the time, of kind of having done all the right things. You know, I was a poor kid, studied hard, got a PhD in physics, and I was married, had children, grandchildren, college professor, had run two successful businesses, which sounds like the description of a full life. Well, I always said to people, I said, I don't know what it is I'm supposed to do, but it's not this. And when I saw the second plane at the second tower, I stood up and said, it is jihad. Islam is here. And turned off the television, and in that moment, I knew what my life would be. And it is what it is now, explaining to people the true nature of Islam.
To my own civilization, because I knew how little we knew. And even worse, we were in the negative knowledge on Islam in the sense of those few things we did know about Islam were false. Well, better you know nothing than to know falsehoods.
How many years before 9/11 were you reading the Quran?
You know, I don't recall. I just recall sitting and reading and occasionally throwing it onto the floor because I was so infuriated with what it would say about me and about women or whatever else. By the time I started reading the Quran, I had now spent a lifetime reading religious texts. What started out with that art book way back in graduate school, I had now studied religious texts really for the majority of my life. So when I got to the reading of the Quran the second time, late in life, I had a whole background to measure it against. I read Buddhist sutras, Taoist texts, the Bhagavad Gita. I've even studied the Torah at an Orthodox synagogue. So I was a pretty experienced reader of religious texts when I got to the Quran. So as a result, for one thing, I was determined to push through with it. Later, when I produced my own Qurans, I became aware of the fact that really what the Quran needed was a good editing job. And by that, I don't mean a better translation of Arabic, but just putting things in the right time order and some other simple things like that.
So the 9/11 produced my third reading, if you will, of Islam, and it's the one I'm involved in today. My life completely changed. Changed who my friends were, changed what my social life is. I became somewhat of a recluse because I was bound and determined to make sense of Islamic doctrine. And as I said, it became very clear to me as I studied it that it had been made deliberately obscure and that I wanted to penetrate that obscurity. And it became an intellectual project of mine to make the Quran clear and simple to understand, as well as the rest of its sacred text, the Sirah, the biography of Muhammad, and the Hadith, the traditions of Muhammad. And that's what I did. I have produced a Quran which anyone can pick up and read and understand. And the reason for that, very simply, is I have restored the story of Islam. Because the original Quran, the Quran of Muhammad, involved the story of Muhammad. Since every verse was in a response to Muhammad's needs on the ground, the way you understand the Quran is to understand the needs of Muhammad at the time that verse was written. So in my Quran, Muhammad's life is integrated into it. There's never a confusion in between Allah and Muhammad, but they're both there. So that was my... and by the way, it was, I must say, a delight. Because what happened, Elsa, when I got into the middle of all this stuff, was I realized that no one had ever done a scientific study of Islamic doctrine. Well, I felt like Carter when he thrust the candle into the tomb of the Pharaoh Tutankhamun, because it was a tomb that had not been touched. And so here I was as a scientist, 61 years old, and I had finally found some work that was all original. And so it was... I must admit, it was fun plowing through all of this and making it all make sense in a clear and rational way.
It sounds like it, and it sounds like you used your whole lifetime of training and very different things, because I believe you went through as an engineer or,
yes.
Physics professor.
I had never written at all other than, a memo or a business letter. And so it was very peculiar to find me writing, which, since I didn't know how to write, I settled on just simple sentences. And my brother, who's read me, says, "Bill, you write just like an engineer. Every sentence ruthlessly advances your thesis."
Mm-hmm.
So I'm given to logic and clarity. But now that I find myself an author, but I also find myself doing now what it is I am supposed to be doing. It appears as though all of my peculiarities and quirks and whatnot were all for this purpose. So I now lead a very contented life in a strange way, although I spend my life as a Paul Revere telling people about terrible things. Nevertheless, I'm content with myself. I finally found what it is I'm supposed to do.
Tell us, or tell us about the stages along the way, what you've done, because you certainly haven't stood in one place from the moment you, things came together. What's the evolution been? What have you written when? How did you, make a decision right from the beginning that you were going to be as public as you could, that you would use your own, you know, that you would go on stage, that you're not hiding behind?
Oh, yeah. Well, all of this came about slowly. At first, there was just the intellectual challenge. And then finally, once I could, as I say, crack the Quran code, which took an amazing amount of work, by the way. I have a printout of the Quran, and as you go over my printout, you'll discover that every verse is highlighted in one of, it turned out, seven colors, because that was one of the things that I realized that there was there were some statistical patterns here. And so by color coding each of the different kinds of verses, you could, by the time this was over, you could hold up a sheet of this paper across the room and easily tell what the natural divisions of ideas were. So that was a delightful discovery. And I also realized that statistics would give the best interpretation of the Quran. And out of the statistics, I discovered the principle of dualism, which is that in all of its text, Islam always has two stories to tell. Can we say a good story and a bad story? Or at least a story that's peaceful and one that's violent. So it was really a scientific delight for me to go through these texts and discover the statistical reality that was behind them.
But you didn't stay there.
I seem to have been the first scientist who's ever done this work.
I think that most people just pick passages or get the general feeling of Medina and Mecca, mm-hmm. and what's generally happening and the general tone of more peace, much more violence and bloodshed.
Right.
So, no, I haven't ever heard of anyone who did anything like what you did.
Well, I knew that it couldn't be chaos, which is what most people sort of presume. Well, it's just chaotic. But I've done some work in cryptology, and I know that it is impossible for a human being to produce a random anything. Mm-hmm. Anything that a human being produces, there is always a pattern, even if that pattern is obscured. So it's odd that some of my study of cryptology entered into my study of the Quran.
Okay, so you had the intellectual exercise. It was fascinating. You found things that others hadn't done. It was mm-hmm. your own. You were Christopher Columbus or whatever your model is, Carter.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not, in fact, how I introduced you. Because I sang...
I'm a speaker.
Speaker, yes. That's really, really different. How did you take that movement from private researcher, scholar, recluse, to international speaker?
What happened was that after I got the text done, I foolishly and naively thought that people would line up to get them. Oh, you've made the Quran clear and easy to understand. Oh, we want to know. Well, what I discovered was is that the great majority of the society I live in was desperate to remain ignorant by believing any sweet lie. So I there was not a rush to buy my books. Much to my disappointment.
I'm going to interrupt here because I have likewise been shocked. So I think that what you're talking about is something that so many of us hit, an incredible surprise when we say something, and people may at best, most people may at best reluctantly listen. As I'm thinking of somebody I know who for years when I've said anything about Islam says, well, I have to discover for myself. And I go right ahead. And I don't say much. And then I mentioning something a year later that I'm doing, it's like, I'll have to look into that for myself.
But the person isn't saying I have to look into it for myself. They're saying, I don't trust you, yet the same person will trust me about anything else.
Oh, yes, that is odd, isn't it?
So you've had the same experience.
That leads us, Elsa, to the second great question of Islam, and I have finally answered that question.
Mm-hmm.
The first great question of Islam is, what is its true nature as determined by its text? Okay, that to me was the first great question. What is the true meaning of the Quran? What is the true meaning of Muhammad's life? Well, once I had those done, I bumped
into
the fact
that could you give us just a quick, tell us a little what you think it is?
Oh, you mean the true nature of Islam?
Yeah.
Well, it's the true nature of Islam is based on two principles. The first principle is that of submission, which the name Islam relates to. So this submission process is to either be done through charm, and if charm doesn't work, violence will work, or some other sort of social pressure. The second great principle of Islam is dualism, in that Islam always has two answers for every question. It has an answer that's based on religion and what we call the Quran of Mecca, that is Muhammad's early phase, which was, although argumentative, was not physically violent. But then we have a different Muhammad. So there are two Qurans, there are two Muhammads, and this is all part of this dualism because they contradict each other. I mean, like one of the verses of the Quran is, you have your religion and I have mine. Let there be no compulsion in religion. And then, of course, we have all the other verses which are about jihad. Now, most people say, well, which is the real Muhammad, the peaceful religious man or the warlord in Medina? Because they contradict each other. But I've been trained in quantum mechanics, and I knew that one of the valid views of reality which we've been forced into is that you can have a reality which has two different manifestations. Is the world made of energy or is the world made of matter? Well, the answer is yes. And although that may seem contradictory, it depends on the circumstances and what you're looking for. So the second great truth of Islam is dualism, and that is its enormous strength. Because since there's good stuff, people run around talking about, well, let there be no compulsion in religion. And that's, see, Islam is peaceful. Because as a Western mind, once you've established there's peace in Islam, that means there can't be war. But it turns out Islam embraces both sides of the contradiction, both sides of the paradox, and they're both equally true. It's just you use which one you need when you need it. So that's the true nature of Islam. It is based on submission in that everybody has to do everything the way Muhammad wants it done. Now, that everybody doesn't just include Muslims. When you read the Torah, its rules are about how to be a Jew, and they do not make demands on the Gentile. Well, unfortunately, Islam makes demands on everybody. Everybody. So that's the problem with Islam, is it does not stay on its own reservation. So anyway, that's the true nature of Islam. Everybody's got to do everything Muhammad's way, and Muhammad always has two stories.
And I sidetracked you because you were going to go to... There you were?
The second great... What? Yeah, well, the second great question is, why are we so afraid?
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody, once they reach the stage of... Well, this is what it really is, and gosh, it's not hard to understand anymore. A sidebar here. There has been one of the great intellectual revolutions in Western world since 9/11. The first great amateur revolution was in the early 1700s with amateur physicists such as Sir Isaac Newton. Sir Isaac Newton was an absolute amateur. A Cavendish, Hooke, all of these people, an early chemist and early physicist, were all self-taught amateurs. Well, what has happened in the field of Islamic studies is that there's been a second great amateur development. It turns out that all the university scholars are, for all purposes, useless to themselves and others because they wind up being apologists for Islam. But since 9/11, we've had great scholars like Andy Bostom, Robert Spencer, all apply a fresh, logical mind to the subject, and without prejudice, because the university scholars are just dreadful on the subject. They're pimps for Muhammad.
Mm.
There's no critical thought that I've ever seen manifested in university thought on Islam, all apologists. So anyway, we've had that second great intellectual revolution in the West created by amateurs, and that has been the present-day scholarship on Islam. And what this means is, now then, anybody who wants to know Islam can. What has to keep you away from it is some sort of bullheadedness or fear or whatever else.
Okay,
so that led to this.
So what I want you to tell me is your journey from recluse to big public speaker, international speaker. In other words, you have managed to get heard by some people somehow. Tell us about the stages, because you didn't just wake up one morning and say...
Well, now you got to remember, I've already tried publishing books. Now, supposedly, you can do magical things on the web with a web page and optimizing for Google, and this will produce massive book sales. Well, I tried that, and it didn't work. So, you got to remember that I was a college lecturer for 8 years, and standing up and going on about a subject that I know is as natural as buttering a slice of bread. So, you know, I don't even remember the first talk I gave, to what group it was, but there were people who were interested, and so I began to speak to them, and that was about 5 years ago.
So there was about a five-year gap between I'm interested and I'm researching to I'm going out in the world.
Right. Now, a lot of that time was spent, by the way, in writing books, more books, because the other thing I had after I wrote put the Quran, the Sirah, and the Hadith out, I thought, well, I'll write more interesting books on smaller subjects. And so part of my attempt to publicize my work was to write different books, like a book on women, a book on slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But what had to happen was you had to get out in front of people. And since I don't mind speaking to a crowd, that's what I started doing.
So first of all, you would speak locally, and then you would get known.
I'll tell you what my business plan is. You'll be amazed. I never solicit business.
Okay.
I never refuse a call. And if you'll go back over our relationship, how did it work? You called me.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've done is I've just patiently given talks and had people tell people. It's the old-fashioned word of mouth. Until finally today, may I say, that I now get called very frequently to do talks. Let's see, last week I did three talks last week. So it's now become very common. Because what is happening is that people are limbering up a bit. They are beginning to admit that they want to know something. And so just by word of mouth, I am rather busy giving talks.
It sounds like there may also be a larger community out there to invite you to
speak
than 10 years ago.
Yes. Oh, yes. People are beginning to... I tell you what. Today, I usually, in my house... we say that I know everything that happened 1,400 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and my wife knows everything that's happened since 9/11. My wife turns out the Bulletin of Christian Persecution and the Bulletin of the Oppression of Women. She's an internet researcher. So it's very odd that I would ever send her information. I sort of live with an intelligence officer. I rarely ever get on the web because all I do is click open links that she sends me. But this morning I sent her one. And I said, we're winning. And I sent her a link to an article in the Wall Street Journal. And the article, what you do, now my wife taught me this. On the internet, scan the article and read the comments. First off, the article involved the subject of political Islam, which is my coinage.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, in the very beginning, I said, we will not beat the religion of Islam because of the First Amendment in America. But we can beat the politics of Islam. And so I coined the term political Islam, which is now found in U.S. News, or no, USA Today, and Wall Street Journal. So the usefulness of that term is now becoming apparent to everybody. And that's one of the reasons I think people are more willing to talk about it, is that they're finally understanding that Islam is not just a religion. Part of its dualistic nature is it is both religious and political. So we're, but anyway, these comments in the Wall Street Journal about political Islam were all fact-based. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying here is that knowledge of Islam is now reaching the popular knowledge, that people who are readers of the Wall Street Journal or readers of magazines and stuff now know enough to, because the intellectuals in our society are vast traitors to our own civilization. They have been unwilling to do critical thought. I gave a talk at Vanderbilt University in called the A Rational Study of Islam, and in it I showed all my charts and statistics. Well, when the talk was over, a man stood up in the back of the room and started screaming at me that I knew nothing about Islam, that I had insulted years of his work, that I should never be allowed on any political campus under any circumstances, or any campus under any circumstances. The man was the head of the Islamic Studies Department, and he behaved like an absolute ass, just pointing his finger and screaming at me. Now, if he had addressed any fact that I had spoken of, it would have been an interesting discussion. But he was incapable of bringing forth a single fact that I'd given to prove it wrong. It was just that I was a bad person. This is the head of an academic department of supposedly a fine school.
I think that that is the weapon of choice.
Yeah.
For people.
Well, what
who...
you start off with saying. Oh, they call us bigots. They call us Islamophobes.
Yeah.
But they never, ever address a single fact. They just say, oh, you're an Islamophobe.
It's like
I've never been told I'm wrong.
It's like when if you're upset about something and someone looks at you and says, you're really angry, and you go, whoa, well, you know, that happens to be true, and you just ram through a red light into the side of my car.
Right.
And you expected me to come out of the car smiling? I probably have whiplash. And what are you addressing?
Right.
The fact that you ran a red light, that you slammed into the side of my car?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, you're upset that I'm angry.
Right.
Whoa, I was at a stop sign, stopped. I'm remembering somebody who ran into the side of my car and got out, and totally in the wrong, and got out of his car screaming his head off at me. And I'm like, well, right, let's not deal with the facts. I was really glad he tried to get his car towed away before the police came. The police came, and they were going, give us the facts, ma'am. Whoa.
Right.
So,
well, anyway, we have the facts on our side, and our opponents have charges of bigotry on their side. And I think the public in general, though, is beginning to understand that there are facts to be known about Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, that some of these facts are becoming more and more in your face. Mm-hmm. For instance, I'm finding that the churches are finally beginning to realize, some of them, that you know what? There are people dying every day simply because they go to church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. So the public is beginning to awaken. The elites are, I think that they're bunkered up totally. I think that the elites realize, that, and when I say elites, that's like this department head at Vanderbilt. They're beginning to realize that their control of the dialogue is slightly shifting away from them, and people are not listening to their apologia for Islam. So I think one of the things that the study of Islam is doing is it's helping to destroy political correctness, because it's political correctness they keep throwing at us. I like to tell people, I am the true multiculturalist. I study Islam, and I speak of it in its own terms. I accept the civilization of Islam, and you, sir, reject it because you say, oh, I don't need to study it. It's just like ours. Well, it's not. But I think we're making progress, Elsa.
What I'm hearing from you, because many people are discouraged, they're going like, oh, my God, I don't know how we'll ever get there. What I hear from you...
No. There are positive signs.
I'm hearing that though there's a lot of opposition, you're hearing less than 5-6 years ago, let alone 10. Mm-hmm. I don't hear that you're having a hard time holding out in the face of denial or anything. I hear that you're, in fact, enthusiastically charging into the fray with facts and more facts and more facts.
Right. Well, I told a woman who asked a discouraging question in the at a lecture I gave, and I said, well, let me tell you one of the things you need to do. You need to learn from Muhammad. I said, you have done something once, and you are now discouraged. I said, Muhammad never, ever quit. He went at it again and again and again. So you're telling me that you would like to defeat Muhammad, but you're not willing to learn a lesson from Muhammad. The first duty of any warrior is to maintain their morale. Now, that doesn't mean you don't do critical analysis of your position, but I find that there are people who are easily discouraged. And so I advocate that they need to imitate Muhammad. He was discouraged, but he kept on going, and we have to do the same. The reason is simple. This is not a matter of a funny church on the corner that meets on Friday. If it were about religion and a funny church that is a mosque, you and I wouldn't be talking. I would be out of my wood shop because I'm a good woodworker. But instead, we'll have to edit this. I've lost my train of thought.
That's totally fine. I think, in fact, this is not just a church. It's not just a religion.
No. What we have here, what we're defending, is not another church on the corner. What we're defending is our civilization. Elsa, here's the way it breaks down. The civilization of Islam, I just got to early telling you, is based on two principles, submission and dualism. It's based on the ethical principle of dualism as well. Our civilization has as its ideal the golden rule. What does that mean? Everyone is treated under the same ethical system. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Which others? All others. But Islam has an ethical system which is based on not all others, is not inclusive, but instead has one set of rules for the believer and another set for the unbeliever. The other difference is this. Our civilization has as its intellectual ideal critical thought. Do we meet that all the time? Goodness gracious, no. But it at least is the ideal. And the ideal thought inside of the world of Islam is authoritative thought. You don't use critical thought. You look it up. What did Muhammad do? And if someone wants to think outside the Muhammad box, there are rules in the Sharia for their punishment. So what we have here is a civilization based on dualism and authoritative thought, which is determined to crush a civilization based on the golden rule and critical thought. So this is not a funny church on the corner problem. This is not a different piece of gear to wear outside for clothing. This is about the survival of our civilization. And that's the reason for the struggle.
You've talked about some people being discouraged. In your own case, what have been the most helpful things that stop? Because I don't hear discouragement. What's been most helpful to you in terms of keeping your morale up?
Well, let's go back to my grandmother. My grandmother raised three families. I was the member of the third family she raised. I never heard my grandmother ever complain. She had a dying husband. We lived in a four-room shack. Her dying husband took up the front room. She never complained. So I was taught early on to never whine. Never be the victim, ever. I mean, we barely had a pot to pee in, but we did not view ourselves as being in. We were what was called poor but proud. So early on in life, I became very used to adversity. But I was also instructed by a woman to never give in. She was as tough as a hickory knot. And I guess I wound up to be just the same.
It sounds like you have a lot of respect for women.
Oh, an enormous amount. I was raised by a grandmother and a mother. I have two daughters. And oddly enough, even all the cats I ever owned were female. But I only like strong, independent women. I can't stand the wuss kind.
And to that, for that, you also have to thank your grandmother.
Yes.
So the biggest support isn't something outside you, like friends or like-minded people.
Nah.
Or the biggest support is an internal thing that you can, in fact, it's like your grandmother within, or mm-hmm. the backbone inside you, your personality that, you know, it sounds like it's the things inside you that are the most mm-hmm. powerful things. So that if people are weak, other people might need more friends or like-minded people. And you're not saying other people shouldn't have different needs. But for you, there's nothing quite like that inner hickory stick.
No, exactly. Mm. Exactly. So anyway, that's, again, it's odd reflecting on it. And I've done this. I'm now 71, and so I've got fewer tomorrows than yesterdays. So in terms of looking back, it's kind of odd how the whole thing I spent a lifetime getting away from turns out to be one of my greatest strengths.
I don't know what you spent your life getting away from. Religion?
Well, you got to remember now, I was raised in a culture which was very narrow, all mm-hmm. right, and not very intellectual. And I was the brainiac in the crowd. So and there was also it was very isolated, okay. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see more. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lifetime getting out of there, but now then I discover that now that I'm out of there, I sort of took it with me. Does that make sense?
It sounds also like you are exploring a closed society, as closed as your childhood society in many ways.
Well, you know, I had not thought of that, but yes, there is a parallel there.
Like, because you left it, but you left it. You didn't want to spend your life, or even
right.
you didn't explore your own society going, what made them so close-minded, but then look
well,
at the
actually,
religion.
Well, actually, I did.
You did, okay.
There's a period in my life in which I lived for 15 years in the Northeast, and I moved to a land in which supposedly everybody was very intelligent, and there was no bigotry, or at least that's what they had told me in the media for all my life. When I went to the Northeast, I discovered that it was not quite what they told me. First off, I'd never met anybody any smarter than me, so I'm like, where did all the real smart people go? And then as far as bigotry went, it was just more sophisticated. So that was one of the things I learned by getting away from it, was those people who had spent their media dollars criticizing me were not who they said they were. So, but I guess that's not the first time that's been discovered.
No. I want us maybe to start getting towards the end of this, and that is, you've spent mm-hmm. now 11 years of your life passionate about this, going further and further with this. Where do you see we are now? You seem to see more rays of hope.
Yes.
Well, where do you think we are now in terms of taking on Islam, really understanding what it's about, countering mm-hmm. things that are damaging to... For me, it's less Western, because I don't care if it's Western or Eastern, Northern or Southern. I care that it's the right to flourish, the right to
right.
live lives
mm-hmm.
that are right to us. I don't care where you are. So I know that those are, quote unquote, Western
well,
values.
Let me give you an example here in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
We have a situation in Tennessee where our Republican governor, who's been here in office for 2 years, has recently bent a knee towards the Muslim Brotherhood. On two different occasions, he's had a Muslim Brotherhood group come in and give talks on Islam, one to law enforcement and the other on some kind of social services group. He also appointed a woman who is a Muslim who has experts in Sharia finance. And so what happened when this expertise came out in just a routine announcement of her appointment to some economic development board, years of running up and down the interstates of Tennessee, along with lobbying work in the legislature, has produced a sensitized population. What has happened here in Tennessee is there are every GOP the GOP, the Republican Party, has 95 county groups, because there's 95 counties in Tennessee. We wrote up a resolution condemning not the hiring of the Muslim, but the putting in place by decree the beginnings of Sharia law. We've already had, in 2 weeks' time, seven counties sign a resolution condemning any aspect of Sharia law. Well, this is now front page news in the local newspaper. The point is this: we are now able to put political pressure onto an elected official who is a billionaire governor, and he is now hearing from us. This is an entire new level of political involvement. We can now dish out political pain, which has never happened before. So this is an enormous advancement. The Muslims are making advancement in that they're bringing in the first beginnings of Sharia law into the executive branch of the government. But the other development is that we're pushing back and hard. Our goal is in 2 years that for every candidate who runs for office in Tennessee, whether it's for school board or governor, that they have to answer the question, where do you stand upon the implementation of political Sharia in Tennessee politics? Mm-hmm. We want to make that question a hot-button issue, and we're now beginning to get the political muscle to do so. So that is an incredible advancement. The other advancement is that in the local media, those who oppose Islam are now recognized as a political force. Now, this has been very begrudging, and they still call us haters and bigots, but nevertheless, they now have to admit that we are a rising political force in Tennessee.
It sounds as if a potential next step is having a governor who is naturally aware of what does Sharia stand for, such as the submission of women, such as all kinds of things. But given that that is not yet the case, hopefully not yet.
What we have now is the governor now is ignorant and nice. Our worst disease in our nation these days is nice. Now, that may sound like a cruel thing to say, but what I mean is that the governor says that, well, she's a nice person. Well, hello, governor. We weren't talking about the person. We're talking about the doctrine she represents.
Hitler liked dogs. I don't mean he was a nice person. I think he was probably a rotten person. But I totally agree that niceness is not an adequate criterion for anything. It's a great conflict avoidance thing. Nice people usually don't want conflict.
Exactly. I'll never forget, by the way, there was a killing in which the guy thought, he said about the man he killed, he says, I thought he was a nice man up to the point I slit his throat. And I always thought to myself, well, that was an insight. and by nice, I mean we shouldn't be kind. But nice has become a saccharine, overly sweet. We in America today, we don't like hard-edged things. If we can possibly nuance them out of existence, we'd like to do so. And so I, of course, am determined to bring the whole question into high profile.
I think that there really is something around the nice things. This is not interviewing you, but one of my things is that people are taught they're not allowed to think critically, all opinions are equal, all cultures, everything, because they don't want any of the mess. So it's conflict, it's problems, and the nice thing is part of it all. If they're nice, we don't have to look at that. Bah.
Well,
so
it's a niceness which leads to denial, inquiry.
Mm-hmm. A niceness allows you to
keep
denying.
We're not going to investigate that.
Yeah. Do you have any messages to other people? Any concluding messages? You know, aside from, it sounds like, keep going, find pressure points, do political activism. Any other messages for people that you have?
I would say that, what messages do I have? Well, first off, we're going to win. Let me start with that. And the reason we're going to win is our choice is annihilation or winning. There's not some third multicultural choice in which everybody's going to be a happy United Nations living together. That is not going to be the answer, in spite of the fact the elites tell us that. This is an ideological war, so I would say to anyone who's interested, that means you need to become a warrior, and what that means is you need to learn a little bit. And this is work well worth doing. As I started off by saying, if you join this fight, you will meet wonderful people who are compassionate, courageous, and above average in intelligence. So I would say seize the day, defend our civilization.
Very much a good place to be ending this, seize the day.
It's a wonderful civilization we have, Elsa. It is worth defending. And I know it has its faults, and were it not for Islam, I could sit here and talk to you at length on the faults of our civilization. But we do not want perfection to become the enemy of good.
I have spent a lot of my life, my teaching career, teaching in favor of improving our civilization. So
yes.
Fighting for the rights of women, for racial
yes.
equality, for sexual orientation
yes.
equality, all of that have been saying that our civilization needs improvement so that we can flourish better. Because a woman can't flourish. Exactly. To say, how can I improve the civilization is not the same as saying, let me let in something that says women are not equal, that, a religion that where there is slavery and something, it's just like, excuse me, I thought slavery was abolished even in your country, and Canada's got a slightly better record, but oh my God. So I totally believe that in improving something, but for that, always you have to show me that what you have is better. So I think it was very easy to show that giving women equal status was better,
mm-hmm.
as in it meant more safety for women, more safety for families, people like my mother being able to get an equal
but
job.
But also, I tell you, another thing the equality of women and the elimination of slavery show is that we adhered to the principle of golden rule and critical thought. If you look carefully, that's the intellectual and moral principle that were behind the elimination of slavery and equal rights for women.
Mm-hmm. I actually like an ancient philosopher, Aristotle. He introduced me to that word flourish, and I remember loving it, except of course he didn't think slaves should flourish or women, but he thought like the goal of life is we need to have the things that let us flourish, and to me it was like yes. So all the things that I've cared about have been for greater flourishing. So for myself, something like Sharia is about the antithesis that
it is the death knell of flourishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yes, and so I think I like your final message. See that this is not about giving space or adding in a slightly different variant to our society. This is something that goes against fundamental values.
Yes. You'll notice we have in our country here many immigrants from China and Vietnam, and they do bring in a slightly different flavor, but it's a slightly different flavor of critical thought and golden rule. That is, we agree with those. If we have that ethical point and that intellectual point, we can get along. But if your ethical point is, I'll lie to you if it advances my agenda, and I will harm you if you don't agree with me, I'm not for that flourishing.
That isn't flourishing. That
it's
is
repression.
Like if I have a rose garden and something is going to destroy my rose garden.
Yes, exactly. So we have something beautiful and wonderful to preserve so that we can improve it.
Oh, yeah, because Canada has also had many things in terms of dealing with Aboriginal people, with what happened to the Japanese during World War II, et cetera, but there has been incredibly a recognition of these things as wrongs. So,
right. We applied the golden rule to them and learned them, and so we won't do them again.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I didn't say we're perfect. I said we have two fabulous ideals that we strive towards,
mm-hmm.
critical thought and the golden rule. and internment of the Japanese turned out not to meet the criteria of Golden Rule. All right, so we did that once, now we don't do it again.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you so much, Bill. It's been a delight. And by the way, on the site, if they go down to your picture and they click on it, they will be able to go over to a link with more on you and a list of the books and where they can go find the books and a contact point where they can contact you if they would like you to come in as a speaker.
Delightful.
I think one of the great things about this is if people really, you know, hey, what Bill says is great. Here, there's a great, easy way where they can contact you and help spread the message.
Great. Thank you so much for what you're doing, Elsa.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Pleasure.